This is Sound and Vision from KEXP. This podcast feed is about to get a new look and have a new format in the coming weeks. We'll have more on that to come soon. But as we look on revamping this podcast, I wanted to share one of Sound and Vision's most popular podcasts in the nearly 5 years this feed has been around for. It's the story of Bam Bam. It was a Seattle-based grunge band led by a Black female vocalist. And this was a band that was performing in the early 80s, before grunge was even a genre. And it wasn't until a few years ago that DJs at KEXP and music lovers started finding out about the band. And a lot of us were shocked that we've never heard of Bam Bam before. And we wondered how and why this band was basically erased from Seattle music history. So back in 2021, KEXP's Larry Mizell Jr. caught up with a few people close to Bam Bam to hear about the band's story and the life of frontwoman Tina Bell.
Just a few months ago, I'm on my phone scrolling through the void, and I get a message from one of my most trusted homeboys. "What do you know about Bam Bam?" he asks. So I'm about to say something about Pebbles when he sends a YouTube link. It tells me that Bam Bam was in fact a band, possibly one of the, if not the, first of the Seattle grunge bands, fronted by a Black woman. Hold up, what? The video is for the song Ground Zero from 1984. How many area rock bands had an actual music video back then that weren't, you know, Heart? It's clearly low budget, but it holds my attention with its green screen background and stormy gray clouds and shots of this young four-piece band goofing off by what looks like Golden Gardens. In the performance shots, the rhythm section is locked in and bombastic. Guitar player effortlessly reeling off a sound that's both sludgy and shimmery. But it's Tina Bell, a petite brown-skinned sister in front, that commands my attention. She's wearing a white leather jacket. Her spiky auburn hair is cropped short. Her eyes regard the camera with an icy calm, her back to the waterfront. Beautiful, cool as ice, total control. Her voice is low, smoky, restrained. It's a total quintessential Seattle rock song, a grunge song. And it sounds like stuff that would come out like half a decade later. I found so little about Bam Bam online, but saw that they'd formed in 1983. I was heartbroken to find that vocalist Tina Bell had passed away in 2012. Bam Bam's brilliant guitarist, Tommy Martin, had been married to Tina. They'd had a son. But sadly, Tommy also passed away just a couple of years ago. It saddened me to discover all this, knowing I couldn't talk to them about their path. You know, I like to think I know a couple things about music, and in particular, Seattle music. I wasn't on the scene by any means, but I've seen the documentaries, read the books, heard the interviews. I've been keenly aware of a grunge industrial complex, and its story's been relentlessly mined from without and within since before I was a teenager. And back then, as an awkward, unrealized Black kid that loved rock, before that was a thing that was really okay, and I didn't see myself reflected in a lot of places, I always looked up to the few Black role models I would see that navigated that world. So how in the world had I never heard of Bam Bam? How did no one ever tell me about Tina Bell?
I came across Bam Bam in the early 80s. There weren't a whole lot of Black weirdos in Seattle. In the scene, we weren't that visible. And so Tina Bell was definitely the queen of all that.
That's Om Jahari, a writer, a musician who was born and raised in Seattle.
For me personally, as a Black woman, I projected myself onto her, and she was someone that I wanted to become.
Om went on to play in the Microns with Reggie Watts. She was the original singer, the beloved AC/DC cover band Hell's Bells. She's in the Bad Brains cover squad, Reignition. She witnessed Tina Bell's power and uniqueness firsthand.
When I saw Tina, it was really like, what in the hell is going on with this greatness, and looking around the room and realizing that all of these white eyes are looking at it too and wondering, how do I do that?
But Om also knew, as a black woman, it wasn't easy.
She's in a city that has a predominant white population, in a state with a predominant white population, you know, in scenes that are predominantly white.
Om recalls being one of the few black faces at shows watching Bam Bam. She recalls them mostly being beloved, but certain reactions stood out.
And I was hanging back, watching some noted celebrities that were in the room, and I watched one celebrity looking at Tina Bell doing her performance and seeing a particular type of jealousy and envy directed at Tina, and it made me realize that, you know, she at that time probably had very few close allies and probably even less closer female allies, because she was, from this particular person, seen as an obvious threat. Tina was 5'2". Her power on stage is indescribable. She was a powerhouse and gorgeous. I mean, beautiful. And she was unapologetic.
Om says she witnessed some of the white women and some of the white men in that room seeming to take Tina as a threat and not fully supporting her because of that.
And so if you're operating in predominantly white spaces and you have no real accomplices or allies in your respective gender, then, you know, she's getting a lot of daggers thrown at her and a lot of trash talk just because people are insecure about who they are.
Okay, so this sounds very familiar. It's a particular kind of difficulty existing as a black person in the Great Northwest, particularly Seattle. I've always said this place does a few things really well. Coffee, rock and roll, and erasing black people.
Seattle has long had a practice of, one could call it unconscious exclusion, and some can call it conscious exclusion of black creators or black folks who are creating sound.
Om points out that Jimi Hendrix himself had to leave Seattle to get his fame. Let's go back to Tina.
We're talking about a woman who creates a genre of music with the band that she's in. And in that band, she's still the only, you know, black person trying to do what she's trying to do, but also trying to make sure that people don't whitewash who she is.
Omen's work to try to preserve Tina Bell's legacy. She wrote a blog post about Tina a while ago and has been working with Bam Bam's former bassist, Scotty Ledgerward, a.k.a. Scotty Buttocks, on Bam Bam and Tina's Wikipedia page. Now, Scotty's been an outspoken defender of Bam Bam and Tina Bell's legacy.
First impressions of Tina was absolute awe. I mean, it was like meeting a classic movie star or royalty. You know, it was a regality about her, but it was not an arrogance at all. She was very approachable, but, you know, extremely confident and absolutely overwhelmingly beautiful. She was proud of who and what she was, but, you know, she didn't want to be her being a black woman to be the primary focus of, you know, her music legacy. But fact is that a huge part of what made her music so great was because it came from the unique perspective of a black woman.
But Scotty, too, saw the adversity that she faced firsthand.
We had one incident in Seattle with some, in fact, it was one of the most horrifying things I'd ever seen, really. She'd been apparently called something and didn't appreciate it. Started swinging the microphone around and around, smashed this guy in the head, busted him open. He goes down. Tommy actually leaps off the stage with his guitar still strapped on him. And by then, though, the crowd had taken him out. It was crazy as hell. But she didn't want to be called that and wasn't going to take it. That's the only time that ever happened, by the way. In Seattle, she was adored. I mean, it was not a question of, oh, isn't she a great singer? It was a question of, oh, my God, look at that singer. It was just something that never happened before. She was so unique and had such passion. I mean, her presence was not to be ignored.
Scotty says that while Bam Bam didn't hit national fame, they still resonated mightily with their fans.
The real problems wasn't from the other groups or the people on the scene, you know, the fans or anything. They adored Tina. They didn't like her. They loved her. I think it was further up the food chain where problems, folks with suits, I guess, could not imagine that America could accept this girl, even though the audience was clearly adoring her, and that's kind of a marketing mess up there, pals.
Bam Bam had apparently been courted by local label CZ Records, but nothing seemed to have come of it. Their first recorded music is actually the first Seattle rock recorded by Chris Hanzek at the legendary Reciprocal Recordings. Bam Bam independently put out their Villains Also Wear White EP in 1984. Hanzek was quoted in Billboard saying that the next band he worked with was Green River, generally regarded as the first grunge band, who wouldn't put out their first record till 1985. There was clearly something in the water, as they say, and bands like Green River, The Melvins, and Malfunction were all up and running around the same time, as well as a handful of more straight-ahead punk bands. This isn't to necessarily insist that Bam Bam was the first grunge band, but I keep coming to this. As a band that was so early on in that scene, and so clearly stood out amongst those bands, why don't people know about them? I can't help but suspect that the answer to that is something I already know, and have known my whole life about this place. Here's Scotty again.
It's frustrating that Seattle will not acknowledge one of its most accomplished daughters. That really frustrates the hell out of me. I mean, she was an innovator with no peers, you know? Critical component to the creation of the music format called grunge that later forgot she even bloody existed. You know, it's not the first time a person of color helps develop a new idea and doesn't get credit for it, but it's a pretty good example of it.
Right on, Scotty. Well, tell me, what do you see as Tina Bell's legacy?
Her legacy? The mother of grunge, the queen of grunge town, there you go.
Another person who's been fairly vocal in their support of Tina's legacy is Bam Bam's very first drummer, Matt Cameron. He was still new to Seattle when he joined the band in 1983, but he'd moved on by 1984. He went on to help found a little group called Soundgarden, which changed his life and the lives of a lot of people worldwide. Today, he's drumming for a band called Pearl Jam. I got to ask him how he joined Bam Bam.
Well, I answered a one ad in the Rocket. At the time, we had this local free music publication called The Rocket. That's how I met Tommy and Tina. It was around 1984, late 83, something like that. It's so long ago. But when I took my drums over there and I set up and I met Tommy and Tina and Scott, beautiful little kid named TJ. Tommy and Tina had this beautiful little happy family.
Matt says she was warm off stage, a great hugger, and just had an unforgettable presence on stage.
Tina was one of those charismatic, gorgeous front women. She just had it.
And clearly, Tina had it. Matt is obviously extremely accomplished and well qualified to speak to her proper place in the pantheon of Seattle Rock City. He likens Tina to the iconic vocalist of legendary Seattle bands like Soundgarden, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Pearl Jam.
I played in tons of bands, but then when I would meet these people in Seattle that were just like these kind of unicorn people like Chris and Kurt and Tina, Lanigan, like just all these like incredible singers, man. Eddie, Lane Staley. So I think Tina kind of is part of that generation that I came up with that had like some of the best rock lead singers, I'm going to say ever.
Here's another thing I had to tell you. Tina and Tommy's son, TJ Martin, he grew up to be a filmmaker who won the 2011 Oscar for Best Documentary Feature for his documentary Undefeated.
And the Oscar goes to Undefeated, TJ Martin, Dan Lindsay, and Rich Middlemouse.
He also picked up the 2017 Primetime Emmy for Exceptional Merit in Documentary Filmmaking for his film LA 92. And obviously, he had the most intimate bond with Tina and Tommy.
Growing up, post Bam Bam days, my dad would often reminisce about the band, my mom not so much.
While Tina didn't talk too much with TJ about her experience in the band, he did end up finding some letters she wrote while on tour.
And she actually tells a story about performing a show in San Francisco. And this, she says, this little punk kid started spitting at her on the stage. And my mom had experienced that same thing in Seattle. And she, without hesitation, she stopped the show, took the mic and bashed him in the head and chewed him out on stage. And the producer had to run out to the stage and tell her, hey, that's actually like a thing right now that kids have been doing, right, is spitting in respect. And so, right, she was like, it doesn't matter, f*** that. Yeah, right. But it all stems from the experience, you know, in what we like to have thought was liberal Seattle, experiencing people dropping N-bombs and spitting not out of respect on her on the stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to her credit, you know, here's this, she's 5'2". And this is the days of like those big heavy mic stands. This isn't a wireless mic. She would use that thing and wield it as a weapon and without any fear, just kind of stand her ground.
Tina was tiny, but 10 feet tall on stage with a huge voice who'd learned to hold her own as the oldest girl in a set of 10 siblings in Seattle Southland. But she still had to walk through a world that was built to crush her. I imagine her frustrations had to be the kind that not even her former bandmates could fully understand, since they could never experience it firsthand. She was in a scene surrounded by white punks, bemoaning an existential alienation she understood better than most.
Where my mom is actually living the emotions that they are performing, right? Right. That is, she doesn't just perform that on stage. When she leaves stage, she's still a black woman, right, who has to deal with the same maybe even worse. Yeah. Than the perception that she's experiencing on stage.
TJ says his father was more vocal about his frustrations around the band not achieving more success and then being left out of Seattle's story. He says he kind of saw Tommy piecing it together as he looked back.
What I had to discern was the difference between, is this a disgruntled artist who never found that they got their due, or is what he's saying have a tremendous amount of legitimacy in terms of the racism that they experience as a band as a result of having a black woman as a lead. And, you know, the version of systemic racism within the music industry. Let's be real, like the industry not knowing and understanding how to position them, thus looking them over. So yes. It's very much him seeing a pattern of how they're dismissed that he starts to kind of put all the dots together and starts to recognize the types of things that are being said, the types of experiences that they're having at shows, the types of promises that were made in terms of, you know, because then you start talking to their peers and the frequency with people saying that they, you know, they opened up for so-and-so, but they blew the headlining act out of the water. You hear that kind of frequently. And then they'd get these promises to be, you remember the Rocket magazine? They'd get these promises to kind of be on the cover of the Rocket, and then those opportunities would fall through. And, you know, you start to realize it's not that it's happening once, it's happening with frequency. That was actually the beginning. And from my understanding, that was the impetus for them to go to London for a couple of years. So, you know, what do you do at that point when you're trying to be honest to who you are and represent who you are, yet the world either wants to fetishize you or dismiss you altogether because they don't know where to put you. They don't know where to place you. They don't know where you fit. So keep it pushing.
Tina and the boys tried their best to make it happen, even moving to London in the late 80s, hoping to break out in Europe since they couldn't seem to get much traction in Seattle. She ended up leaving the band around 1990 and it continued without her in different forms. Tina ended up leaving performing music behind entirely.
It's not that she left Bam Bam. She left music and left the scene and really like retracted herself to the point where on it, I mean, to be honest, she was a hermit for kind of till the very end, until she passed.
It's really hard to learn that she pulled away from music to that degree. Tina gave up on performing utterly. She still enjoyed her Doors, Metallica, and Sinatra records, but was totally away from the public.
She literally did a 180, you know, as being someone who's up front and center, really embodying the things she feels and expressing herself on stage, to the second half of her life, the second chapter of her life, doing the complete opposite and retracting. And I can't help but think about what other things that she was experiencing to go so far the other direction for someone who legitimately loved to perform and loved to sing, you know, and just ran the other direction. It's something I think about a lot.
By this time, Tina and Tommy had split up, which meant Tina was off on her own.
It's not that she retreated and just like was doing a day job here and there. She legitimately became a hermit and, you know, like lived in an assisted living, would kind of every once in a while like volunteer at the church, or she was, you know, for a while she was getting paid under the table as a janitor at a church. And she kind of lived in this, you know, low-income housing, you know, where you pay like whatever you make that month, you pay like, you know, 15% of whatever that comes in that month. By the time I hit high school, that was the state of affairs until she passed in her 50s. Like I said earlier, I often think about what were the struggles in addition to the ones that I could kind of speculate, or the ones that she did kind of talk about. You know, in the later days, her mental health definitely started to decline. And I think she struggled with alcoholism until the very end. She died of cirrhosis of the liver.
Tina Bell passed away in 2012 at the age of 55. At the time, she was living in Las Vegas, a move, TJ says, was to achieve greater isolation. Because she was alone, it took a while until anyone realized she had passed away.
So by the time they found her, it had been probably, I think the coroner guesstimated a couple of weeks.
I think about all the ways I've seen this town, or rather people in this city, marginalize and reject Black existence and ignore and erase Black excellence. Some cases, until those Black folks leave or just disappear into themselves. Maybe it's an unconscious function of this place. Maybe it's intentional. Likely, it's both. Either way, heartbreakingly, there doesn't seem like a more apt example of this than Tina Bell. TJ saw this erasure of Black excellence before his eyes following his mother's death.
The management of the place, because they said everything was contaminated, threw out all of her belongings, like her writings, any recording stuff, any of her, like she was a writer and a poet and a vocalist, gone. They threw it out. I didn't find this out until, because they threw it out immediately. I didn't get the call that she'd passed until a week after or something like that. So when I come out there, I'm like, where's her stuff? And they're like, oh, it was contaminated. We had to throw it out. And they saved like a DVD player, a chair, and like a weird poster. That's it. So my brain can't help but take it here, but she continued to get disrespected even in death, right? Yeah. There's no way someone would do that if it was like a high-rise apartment, you know, million-dollar apartments. You ain't throwing out everything in someone's belonging, you know? It's hard to come to terms with that, but it also makes me realize that she was privy of that the whole time. And that came out in the music, and that came out in her performance, and at a certain point, it got exhausting.
Tina's voice, the music of Bam Bam, needs to finally be understood properly as part of the storied history of Seattle rock music, the sound that changed the world. But Tina's story needs to be properly understood, and for the sake of this place, it's something that in some small respect
needs to help change the culture of this place. For Sound and Vision, I'm Larry Mizell Jr. That was Sound and Vision. I'm Larry Mizell Jr. Please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And if you have the means, please consider giving a one-time $20 donation to support this podcast at kexp.org/sound. Thanks for listening.